So we're going to continue our conversation about pricing. Remember, we talked about pricing constraints, pricing objectives. We talked about different pricing strategies and approaches to pricing. We talked about demand-oriented approaches, which includes what? Skimming, penetration pricing. We said were examples, prestige pricing, cost-oriented approaches, which, remember, we talked about cost plus, we talked about standard markup, we talked about target profit as an approach to pricing. And we talked about competitive pricing. Then we talk about loss leaders. Did we talk about loss leaders as a pricing strategy?
Yeah.
How are we going to use loss leaders to drive foot traffic, for example, into our store? So let's go over some of the questions here. All right, so the first question says, the money or other considerations, including other products and services, exchanged for the ownership or use of a product or service is referred to as, go ahead, Jason.
Price.
Price. D. So the best answer is D, price, on page 320. Question two. The practice of exchanging products and services for other products and services rather than for money is
barter.
After all of that, you didn't get one of these?
I didn't get
either. Oh, you guys that came 20 minutes late. Okay, here you go.
Oh,
wow.
No, you did.
Yeah, coach.
That's on YouTube.
All right, so the best answer is barter. Barter, right? The best answer is A, barter. So, what's the difference? What's the difference here between these two terms? What that we're trying to make a distinction. Why is it that we said first price and then we said barter?
Isn't one specific exclusively money and one is like trading?
Yeah, absolutely. So if it's for the exchange of money, that's the price that we pay. If it's the exchange of products or services, then that's barter. The next question says, to increase value, marketers may do any number of things, including decrease price, or both increase benefits and decrease price. And so the best answer is D, increase benefits. So to increase value, marketers may increase benefits, or decrease price, or both increase benefits and decrease price. So do you see why that is? Remember, we had previously talked about value. And we said value is a function of price, quality, benefits, and there could be other dimensions as well. But certainly those dimensions are a key part of value. And we said that value is something that's subjective. It's based on what we perceive to be a good value. And importantly, we said that a good value doesn't necessarily mean inexpensive. And that's what this question suggests, is that something might be a good value. It could have many benefits. So if it has many benefits, then we might be willing to pay more for the added benefits, for better quality. Isn't that the reason why Sony is able to get a premium for their electronics? Because They have more features, more benefits, and the product is of a higher quality. So the perceived value is high, even though the price is also very high. Next question. Who's going to read the next question? Go ahead, Jason.
Creative marketers engage in value pricing with practice of simultaneously increasing product and service benefits and maintaining of decreasing price.
Exactly. So when we talk about value pricing, here it says that if we're engaged in value pricing, the price of simultaneously increasing product and service benefits and maintaining or decreasing the price is an example of value pricing. Who could explain that to us? What do we mean when we talk about value pricing? Why is that an example of value pricing?
Value pricing, just putting a price, quote unquote, or an amount on the benefit the customer will get from the product. Like, I remember reading it in here, it says like about like the bathtubs, that you have a door that you just step into for elderly and kids. So people are going to spend more money on that because there's an added feature of safety or accessibility, I guess, for hard to reach children or other type of thing. So it's the added price onto it. So maintaining it.
So we could modify a product.
Exactly.
So we don't need to lower the price to add value. We could, as part of value pricing, we could lower the price, but even if we maintain the current price, if we add more features and more benefits, isn't that increasing the perceived value? So product modification is an example of how we could increase value in the marketplace, the perceived value of our product or service. So we have to think about, as we move through the product life cycle, and as we look at the diffusion of innovation model, we have to think about, how are we going to get people to buy the product? How are we going to get more people to buy the product? How are we going to stem that growth that we're experiencing in the product life cycle? So we introduce the product, and then ideally we experience a period of growth. How are we going to continue to sustain that growth? So what this suggests is that we could lower the price. We've talked about that a number of times. We talked about that also recently. Last class we talked about the role of price as it relates to the rate of adoption and the ability to, in an elastic market, to sell more units. But value pricing also suggests that we could also increase the perceived value by not lowering the price, but adding more features and benefits. So isn't that what Apple did very effectively with the iPod? Because there's some challenges that we need to address when we lower the price, even for a promotion. Remember we said, yes, we're going to have a short-term increase in sales because we've lowered the price, even though for us we see that as a TPR, temporary price reduction. But in the minds of most consumers, they don't see it that way. And very often consumers only purchase when the product is on sale. Remember we talked about orange juice that very often retailers promote at $2 for $5. So 2 half gallons for $5. But the price of a half a gallon of Tropicana orange juice, the manufacturer's suggested retail price, is not $2.50. So we have to be careful how we use price to impact demand. Because once you lower the price, it's very difficult to raise the price of the product after that. So let's take the example that I mentioned, the iPod. What they did was actually very clever, because they introduced the iPod. They had a number of models, items, product items, which made up their product line. You remember we talked about that? So they had a product line of MP3 players. And what they did after the introduction was, instead of lowering the price of those items, what they did was, to increase the perceived value, is to keep adding features and benefits. Like, for example, what did they do? They increased the amount of storage space. So the same model, instead of being 20 gigabytes, now it was 30 gigabytes, or 40 gigabytes, or 60 gigabytes, but at the same price. Then they also decided that they were going to introduce the Nano and the Shuffle, which were at a much lower price point that had literally only, what was it, 1 gigabyte? But the initial product line, how much were they selling the iPod for when it first came out? Like $299, $249, $199. But importantly, the key takeaway for us is we observed their pricing strategy, which, by the way, for the other items in their product mix, they've used, over time, they've used different pricing strategies. But the iPod in particular, they didn't lower the price of those items. What they did was just keep adding more features, more benefits. And now it comes with more space. And now it comes with an LCD screen in black and white. And then now it's an LCD screen with color. And you see how we're increasing, by modifying the product, we're increasing the perceived value, which ideally is better than lowering the price for the reasons we just talked about. So if we could do that, if we could keep adding value and avoid lowering the price, in many cases, that would be better. You don't want to get into a price war, because that's going to erode our profits. So if we can, although we said it is a powerful tool in an elastic market, we should try to avoid that. You'll see, for example, companies realize this. For example, shampoo, one of my favorite products. You'll notice that if you go into Target, they have a 16-ounce bottle of shampoo. But what they do is, sometimes instead of lowering the price, they say, now with 20% more free. Now, of course, anybody who's looking at that, do you understand that, well, the value is more. So you're paying the same price, but you're getting a better value? Which, if you're able to do that, I would suggest in many cases, that's better than lowering the price and say, two for $5. So who could tell me why? What is the problem in lowering the price for a sales promotion? No, don't get me wrong. It's not that we don't do sales promotions. Of course, we do sales promotions on a regular basis for a lot of products. But what are the issues that we just talked about? Go ahead, Jacob.
The consumer might get stuck with the TPR, because they'll be like, okay, I only want to buy the product when it's cheap. I don't want to have to spend a lot of money. So instead, by placing the value, like with the shampoo, we're placing more value in the same product with the same price, then people feel like they're getting more.
Absolutely. So we achieve the same goal.
Yeah.
People are going to buy more. They're going to see it as a value. But what happens is, when we have promotions, is that we see a spike in sales, because what we've done is what we call overstocked the customer, or overstocked the trade, which means that if you use that particular brand of shampoo, so instead of buying one that week, you're going to buy two, or maybe you buy three. Well, then next week, you're probably not going to buy any. And the same thing with orange juice and other products. And retailers do that as well, too. That's what we mean when we talk about overstocking the trade, is retailers, if they're able to buy products from the manufacturer at a significant discount, of course, they're going to also stock up in their warehouse. And this week, they're going to buy 1,000 cases of peanut butter. Well, maybe usually they only buy 350 cases of peanut butter a week. But next week, they're not gonna buy peanut butter again.
But in some cases, they'll, for example, sell 2-for-1 orange juice, knowing that it's going off in 2 weeks. So they assume you're not going to drink that much, and then you're stuck with, you're going to finish the one orange juice, but that second orange juice you didn't even drink. So the next week, you're going to have to buy that anyway. As certain things, they know, for example, Costco is one of their big things, is they know people tend not to use a lot of the stuff by the end of the expiration date. So they'll buy it, it will sit around, and then it will go off because they have this giant tub of whatever. It will go off, and next week they'll have to go out and buy the same thing.
And but you also raised something else that another option for us as it relates to managing the pricing component of the promotion, which is instead of saying 2 for $5, you're suggesting buy one, get one free. So we didn't lower the price. We didn't say, well, before it was $10, now it's $5. We said, no, you buy one at $10, the other one we're going to give it to you for free. Do you see how the implementation is different? I think it's reasonable to suggest that the result is going to be the same. The impact on sales is going to be the same. The perceived value is going to be increased. But we didn't lower the price. And so we don't have that issue that Jacob was mentioning, which is that now people are going to think, oh, it's now $5. And that's why when we talked about it, that's why I'd raised a concern about Mercedes selling a $30,000 car. Because when they advertise, they show their symbol, the Mercedes symbol, and $29,999 in every ad. Well, while we talked about creating strong, unique, favorable brand associations, which is challenging. It is very challenging to do that. Creating a logo is not challenging. It takes skill, but to create a brand name, to develop a logo, is not as challenging as creating strong, unique, and favorable brand associations, because that takes a long time to be able to do that. Now, as difficult as it is for marketing executives to do that, it also takes, and it's also a challenge for our target market to make those connections, to make those associations. That being said, how long do you think it takes people to make the association between Mercedes-Benz and $30,000 when every ad that you're running, in like every magazine, shows your logo and symbol and a $30,000 price point? I mean, consumers might be slow to process the messaging, to decode the advertising, but I mean, come on, how many times do you need to see that before you say, I got it, Mercedes is a $30,000 car? So while price could be a very effective tool for us in terms of increasing sales, it's a tool that we have to wield carefully because there's implications. Lowering the price is not a no-brainer decision. Once you lower the price, then you have to live with that. Because like we said, next week, people don't want to spend $4 for half a gallon of orange juice. And do companies do this? Of course, yes, they do it. Do we promote products? Yes. Do we have sales? Yes. But again, my word of caution is, you have to manage that carefully. And once you do that, then you've opened yourself up to certain expectations on the part of your customer. And if you don't promote the product every week, then they know what our schedule is. They know eventually they learn, we promote the product every other week, or we promote it, you know, once a month, and that impacts our behavior. And we could talk for quite a long time about consumer behavior. So it's important for us to understand how our decisions impacts consumer behavior.
Yeah. In terms of what we're talking about, the buy one, get one free, why is it possible that it's a dangerous thing to do in the sense that, why won't someone perceive it as 2 for $10 instead, like the same thing with the orange juice, how we perceive the orange juice 2 for $5. So wouldn't that necessarily, could hurt the way our perceived value is of the product?
Yeah, but you're achieving the same goal, but you haven't actually lowered the price. What you've done is we've changed the perception of the value. See, here we've come out and we said 2 for $5. Here we said, well, you're gonna get you're gonna buy one, and the other one we're not gonna charge you for. You're gonna buy one for $10. That's different than saying 2 for $5, or 2 for $10 would be the equivalent situation. We're not saying it's $2 for $10. That's what I think you're saying. Isn't it the same as $2 for $10? But no, we're promoting it as buy one for $10. It's $1 for $10, and the other one we're not going to charge you. We're going to give you that for free.
Can't perceive that way. That's what I'm trying
to say. Well, ultimately, people perceive it that way, and that's why they purchase it, because that's what's increasing the perceived value. The difference is we didn't lower the price. What we've done is we increased the value that they're getting.
It's the word free that makes the customer really buy into it.
Well, free is a very powerful term in marketing. Definitely. It's effective in headlines. It's effective in direct mail. Certainly free is something that gets the interest of customers. So let's talk about, let's go back and talk briefly about pricing constraints. The next question says, which of the following statements about demand as a pricing constraint is most accurate? And the best answer here, which is talked about on page 325, is E. It says, whether the item is a luxury or a necessity affects the price a seller can charge. So in terms of demand as a pricing constraint, remember we talked about different pricing constraints? Well, here it says that if the item is a luxury item or a necessity, that's going to affect the price a seller can charge. The next question talks about pure monopoly. It says, pure monopoly is the competitive market situation of... What do you think? What's the best answer there? Pure monopoly. I think I heard it here. Who said it?
B.
Yeah, B, in which one seller sets the price for a unique product. Could you think of any examples?
Yeah, iPod. iPhone, I mean.
Oh.
When it first came out, I'm saying. It was like one of the big smartphones out there.
There's definitely some interesting market dynamics there, but the question is, would we consider that to be a pure monopoly? Yeah, so you have, let's see, so I think both of you are suggesting, the electric company or a utility company, which is very often something that we consider to be a monopoly.
Are there any true monopolies?
Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about. Why is that, why would we say, although in general we think that a...
Doesn't Ford used to be a monopoly?
Ford?
Yeah, back in the day.
First came out.
Oh, well, yeah, so in this case it says that for a unique product, there's one seller that sets the price. So if in Ford, back in the day, they were the only ones selling cars, and so it was the Model T, it was a unique product, and they set the price.
The railroad companies,
Johnson & Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson. Oh, tell us why.
Because of what the book said.
Tell us why.
It says that the voters achieve coronary heart disease. Coronary heart disease by juicing stent.
Oh, okay. So the stents that they sell is something that they're marketing, and the example that we're having here is that what the product that they sell is very unique, and that they're the only one that's setting the price. But let's talk about also I want to come back to the issue of utilities. When we talk about utility companies, gas company, electric company, yeah, I think in general it's a good example of a monopoly, but what's the exception? What are we seeing now in the market? Why you might say, yeah, it is a monopoly, but... What was that? I was thinking about natural gas.
You're saying that there are other ways to provide energy? That's why you're saying it's not a monopoly?
No, what I'm thinking is that because what the government has done is they've allowed competitors to enter the market. Now, how does that tie into the government's original motive? Why would they give somebody a monopoly? Why would they allow that to occur?
Because they have incentives from the government?
Yeah, so it is an incentive for the government, but what do you think, Zach? Why does the government say, you know, allow the electric company to have a monopoly, so to speak?
If it's government run or government owned, like they have more control over how many employees they have, and like they can control what the prices are. If it becomes competitive, and they can lose a lot of power in it.
So in a monopoly, as we think about utilities, what the government has realized is that a large infrastructure is needed to provide electricity. It doesn't really lend itself to replicating that infrastructure, right? It's really cost prohibitive, isn't it? I mean, think about telecommunications. I mean, how many companies could you have running cables? How many different companies could you have with towers for wireless communication? So the government realizes that it's impractical to have, and it's not economically feasible to have these vast infrastructures being built, if you could even get investors to invest such an enormous amount of money, right? We're talking about many billions of dollars into creating an infrastructure that's going to be able to provide electricity for a community. And maybe in that case, they couldn't even be profitable anyway. If you had three companies, let's say, providing electricity in a given market, and they each had to invest, let's say, $100 billion, It would seem that it would be unlikely that all three companies could be profitable with such a huge investment. It might be $500 billion. So the government says, yeah, that doesn't really make sense to us. It's impractical. Economically, it's not feasible. But what's happened is they recognize the need for competition. And so what they've done is they've required utilities, and also in telecommunications, this is also another good example of where they required the monopolies to give access to competitors. So in other words, what they do is they have organizations that are resellers of energy, resellers of electricity, resellers of natural gas, that are able to come into a particular market, and they don't have to invest in the infrastructure. They're not going to run their own gas lines. You see what I'm saying? That's why it would be impractical to do that. So, well, you have three companies. They each run different electric wires to your house. This company runs theirs to Matthew's house, and Jason, they have another electric company who's running wires there. Oh, gas. I mean, think of the way that gas is delivered, natural gas. So you're going to dig up all the streets? to run natural gas lines? It's there, but so what the government has said is, yeah, so what you do is you're going to, in effect, sell them a license to use your gas, and you're going to sell the gas to them at a price where they could be profitable, and they're going to resell it to consumers. And that's what happens in wireless communication as well, for example. They share towers. They don't know Verizon, Sprint. You think all these companies have their own towers? That's crazy. Who could afford to, how would they stay in business? So they share towers, and that's how competition is able to exist, for example, in these particular markets, in these categories. Yeah, exactly.
It's not that the government doesn't let you have all that stuff. The government is the opposite. Like, I know for natural gas lines and stuff like that, it's not that other companies aren't allowed to build their own. It's not that other companies aren't allowed to build their own pipes and stuff like that. Just like the government would give a huge company the main contract with the requirement they have to lend it out. Like with phone companies, anybody can start a phone company if they want, and like AT&T legally has to rent out, has to let somebody use their tower if you pay for it. So it's not that they're the only people using it. Like there's no requirement that you need to get power from the state thing. If you can use your own power, you can start your own company doing whatever you want. That's not how it works, really.
That's not what I said?
No, I'm saying you said that the government, they give it to one person just because it costs a crazy amount for all the infrastructure and building all that stuff, because not everybody could just dig into the ground and make a pipe. But.
Right, so then I said that what they do is that they then require, and we've seen this is commonplace now, that they will lease and sublet the gas lines and the towers to other competitors in the marketplace, so that it's not what we would say a true monopoly. So gas, like in this market, you could get gas from somebody else. It's still going to be delivered through the same pipes and so on, but I think that's what Zach's point is that it's not a true monopoly. But certainly the cost of the infrastructure and being able to construct and deploy that infrastructure is certainly something of great concern. Because what if you did have the $500 billion? What are we going to do? We're going to tear up all the streets to run these gas lines? So I think what Zach is saying is definitely a good point. So that reinforces what we were talking about. All right, next question, number 7. Who's going to be number 7? All right,
the maximum quantity of products consumers will buy at a given price is shown by
the demand curve.
Yes. Final answer?
Absolutely.
Yes, hey, the demand curve. That's exactly what the demand curve is. The demand curve shows the maximum quantity of products that the consumer is willing to buy at a given price. Questions about that? And so that's what we've been talking about, is what happens if we change the price? How is that going to impact the quantity demanded? That's why it's so important for us to understand the implications. And the demand curve is a graphic representation of that. And the demand curve is going to obviously vary by product. So the demand curve could look very different depending on the product and the level of elasticity for that given product in that market. So what does that mean? That means that in some cases, you might lower the price 10% and sales will increase by 10%. In other cases, you might lower the price 10% and sales might only increase 5%. Sales might only increase 1%. Or you could lower the price 10% and sales might increase by 20%. So when I say that it's not the same, the demand curve is not the same for all products, that's what I mean. So we need to understand what is the demand curve for our product. How price sensitive is the market for our product? What is the price elasticity of demand? That's what we need to understand. So we need to make some assumptions. Over time, you would expect that we would have some data to support those assumptions. So how would we get that data? Well, go ahead, run a sales promotion. See what happens, 20% off. And then see if we have, if we feel that there's a strong enough correlation between price and the demand for the product. Because remember, there could be other variables that could be impacting demand. So you might think, well, the reason why I sold more shovels was because I lowered the price 20%. Oh, but the fact that we had 3 feet of snow the day before, it has nothing to do with it, right? Maybe you should have raised the price 20%, because now everybody, now the demand is very high and the supply is the same.
So for batteries before blackout.
Exactly. The next question says, the average amount of money received for selling one unit of a product, or simply the price of that unit, is referred to as, what's the best answer there?
Average revenue.
Right, is E, average revenue, on page 331. And remember, we said that we want to look at these metrics. It's important for us to look at these metrics. What is the average revenue? What is the average number of units sold per transaction, for example, in retail? We're very interested in the average number of units sold per transaction. What is the average sale? We're trying to understand, for every sale, how many units are sold? Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? And what is the average sale? Once we know that, then we could try and influence that. And that's why, remember, we said, did you ever notice that when you go to the register, or you're dealing with a salesperson, they would say, would you also want to try this? Would you like to try this in this flavor? Or would you want to see, do you want to see maybe if you would like this t-shirt in blue? Because they know, that's not just random, they know their objective is, the manager told them that the average number of units per transaction is 3, we should try to get that up to 5. And what that means is what? That sales are going to increase. But you need something that's measurable. Like, what does that mean? They say, increase sales. Well, what do you do with that if you work at Banana Republic? Increase sales. Well, that's a strategy. We need some tactics. So, Joe, you work in a place, they say you've got to increase sales. Like, well, what do I do different now than what I was doing last week? So if you know that you're trying to increase the number of items that you sell, right? That's something that's measurable. Okay, so yeah, you're right. I think that's probably based on the data, I believe it, but also based on your observation that, yeah, the typical customer buys 3 items. So on average. So you think we need to try to get that to 5. Or we need to get the average transaction, the average sale, higher. So then you think, oh, you're going to trade them up. So you're looking at a $10 sweater, right? So you say, wouldn't you want to buy ABBA a $50 sweater? And then the average sale per transaction is going to go up. Questions? All right, you guys are great. Yeah. Fantabulous. Orange juice!
Yes. Yes.
All right, next question, number 9. Who's going to read it? Which of the following statements about price elasticity of demand is most accurate? What do you think?
Is it D?
What do you think is the best answer? Somebody. Anybody.
Hey. PC.
Well, yeah, it's definitely either A, B,
multiple
C, or D. Absolutely.
It's
definitely one of those. Yes, B. The best answer is B. The more substitutes a product has, the more likely it is to be price elastic. What does that mean? Who could tell us what that means? Why do you think that's true? First of all, what does that mean when you say there's more substitutes? Yeah, Ari?
If there's substitute would be like butter or margarine, something that someone would buy that's similar, that replaces it, that uses the same...
Pickles and ice cream.
Satisfies the same similar need substitute. So
vodka and
more
orange
substitutes
juice.
If you vodka. Raise the price of a product, the match of people that are going to buy your product are going to be a lot less. So I'm going to buy the substitute because it satisfies the similar need.
So
wow, nice.
What do you think, Joe? You want to add to that?
No, I'm saying it was well worded.
So. Substitute, if there's a substitute for the product, like Ari is saying, if instead of butter, somebody could buy margarine, instead of Pepsi, somebody could buy Coke, or instead of milk, somebody could buy orange juice, then the more likely it is that the product is going to be price sensitive, which means that if we raise the price, for example, if we decided we were going to try to raise the price, then demand would go down. Would go down pretty significantly, actually. Why? Because instead of Pepsi, they'll just buy Coke. Or instead of butter, they'll buy margarine. So the more substitutes that there is for a product, the more likely it is that it is to be price elastic, so price sensitive. Do you think any of the others come close to being logical in any way? That's discussed on page 333. What about this one? It says, price elasticity with inelastic demand must always be greater than 1. What do you think? No. That's the opposite is true, right?
Yeah.
It's not if it's exactly, that's inelastic. If that's elastic. If it's greater than 1, then it's elastic. Right. If it's less than 1, then it's inelastic. So price elasticity with inelastic demand must also be greater than 1. That's not right. What about this one? It says with inelastic demand, reducing price will result in an increase of total revenue. That's not true at all, right? It says with inelastic demand, that means if the market is not price sensitive, then reducing the price is going to increase total revenue? No. If it's inelastic, that means when you lower the price, consumption is not going to increase. Demand is not going to increase. And then it says, with inelastic demand, reducing price will result in an increase in total revenue, though not necessarily an increase in profit. Same thing. If the market is inelastic, that means it's not price sensitive, so whether you increase or decrease the price, demand is not going to change. Now, we said, importantly, that's on a continuum. So a product could be very price sensitive, somewhat price sensitive. It's not just either or, that it's inelastic or elastic. It could be somewhat elastic, it could be very elastic, for example. Questions about that? Are we good?
Yep.
Are we great?
Grand, wonderful.
Yes, Prince. All right. Next question.
More than good, they're great.
The quantity at which total revenue and total cost are equal. This is important. What do you think, Joseph?
I believe the answer, and this was with help from my my good friend over here, Aaron Vega. I believe the answer is A, the break-even point.
Is that your final answer?
Yes. Yeah.
Final answer, yeah. A, break-even point, yes. Why is that important for us to understand that? Because this is a very significant part of our decision-making process, is to understand the break-even point, which here it says it's the point at which total revenue is equal to total cost.
Well, you want to minimally break even because you don't want to take a hit from several products. Even if you might have products out there in part of the product mix, you might have some products that you're not making money off of that are attracting enough attention to help you make money off other products. We don't want to be losing any money in any sense.
And so for a new product, what it does is it helps us to determine whether or not our objective is realistic. It tells us also how many units we're going to have to sell to break even. So is that important?
Definitely.
Yeah, so we need to know, do we need to sell 5,000 units? Do we need to sell 10,000 units? Do we need to sell 50,000 units? Or do we need to sell 1,000,000 units? What if we have to sell 10 million units? So that's going to impact, for example, how much money we spend on advertising. It's going to impact whether or not we're going to even decide to pursue that opportunity. Because what happens if we find out that based on our cost structure and the price that we set, that we would have to sell 10 million units in the first year to break even? But what if I tell you that the entire category is only 8 million units per year? So this is, what are we going to do? We're going to introduce this product, and in the first year we're going to get 80% of the market? We got to ask ourselves, is that realistic? You know, in some mature markets, even getting 1%, is unrealistic. Because when you'll see when people develop business plans, their assumption is always that I'm realistic. I'm not thinking we're going to get 80%. Our business model is based on the expectation that we'll get just 1% of the market. Well, what does that mean? 1% of the market in the beverage category. I mean, you're going to steal share from Coke and Pepsi? 1% of a $200 billion category is substantial. And in some cases, that's unrealistic. So the break-even point is something that's insightful and important for us to understand. All right, let's look at the next group. Remember we said that there's different approaches to pricing. On page 346, here it says, the key to setting a final price for a product is to find an approximate price level to use as a reasonable starting point. Four common approaches to helping find this approximate price level is demand-oriented, cost-oriented, profit-oriented, profit-oriented, and competition-oriented. Who could give us an example of demand-oriented? Demand-oriented approach to pricing.
You see the demand in the market?
Well, what's one of the approaches? What's one of the pricing strategies?
Raise price.
Well, we said that there's a demand-oriented approach to pricing would include, remember we looked at different examples? Penetration pricing is a demand-oriented pricing approach. Skimming, we said, is a demand-oriented pricing approach. Prestige pricing is a demand-oriented pricing approach, which is different from cost-oriented. What were some of the examples of cost-oriented? Cost plus, standard markup, and what about for competition-oriented? What was a good example that we had talked about? Yes, lost leaders is a good example of competition-oriented approach. And what about profit-oriented? What was that?
MAP pricing.
MAP pricing is part of our discussion about the price that, for example, retailers can charge, the lowest price that they're allowed to charge by the manufacturer. Because we said the manufacturer has an MSRP, the manufacturer suggested retail price. And that being said, manufacturers also want to control the minimum advertised price. So there's a certain level that they don't want retailers to sell below. There's a certain price that they don't want them to sell below. So target target profit could be the amount of gross margin, the total amount of dollar sales. What about, the next question says, a skimming pricing policy is likely to be most effective when? When is a skimming pricing policy most likely to be effective? So skimming, remember we said skimming means we start at a high price and lower our price over time. Now when we sell a product, if we introduce a product at a high price, what's one of the things that we might be concerned about if we sell the product at a high price?
People won't buy.
People won't buy, good. That's definitely one. And then what's the other concern? Closely related.
Other competitors.
Yeah, that if you're selling a product at a high price, then it's going to attract competitors. And competitors are going to want to
sell for cheap.
They might want to sell the product for less, but certainly they're looking at, remember we talked about the VCR? You're selling VCRs at $1,100, and obviously it's cost them much less than that, but they decided to deploy a skimming approach, and they're going to lower the price over time. Well, don't you think competitors see that? They're like, we know it costs $20 to make the product. We want to sell VCRs at $1,100 too. So the skimming strategy is really most effective when you know that that's not a problem, that that's not going to attract competitors. Because if the product is going to provide a significant amount of gross margin, then of course it's going to attract competitors. So we also want to understand if there's any barriers to entry. Things that are going to keep competitors out. The next question says, a skimming pricing policy is likely to be most effective when... Which one?
E.
Wait, are we on question two still? Yes, E, right. So question two is E. A high initial price will not attract competitors. All right, next question is also about skimming. So here we get into it in a little bit more detail, and it says that there's several situations when using a skimming strategy is going to be most effective. It says one is that lowering the price has only a minor effect on increasing sales volume and reducing unit costs. Two, the high initial price does not attract competitors, which is what we just said. Three, customers interpret the high price as signifying high quality. Important. And then the fourth situation is A, customers are willing to buy immediately at the high initial price.
Crazy.
So those are the innovators. The innovators and possibly also the early adopters. That's on page 346. So the next question says that in some cases, penetration pricing may follow skimming pricing. The skimming pricing would help C, recoup initial research and development costs, and the penetration pricing would increase market. So, do we follow the scenario there? It says, in some cases, penetration pricing will follow skimming. So what that means is that, yes, we introduce the product at a high price. We want to sell to the innovators and the early adopters. And we're trying to recoup the large investment that we have in research and development, for example. And then follow that by deploying a penetration pricing strategy, which means that we'll then at some point sell the product at a low price. So when we talk about pricing strategy, when we talk about any strategy, it's not like it's forever. It's for a given point in time. So skimming, it's possible to introduce a product at a high price, lower it over time, and then sell the product at a low price to try and sell a lot of units. But the reverse is not true. Introducing the product at a low price, penetration pricing, and then trying to say, now we're going to do skimming? Well, how does that work? How does that work? Questions? Does it make sense? Yeah? Okay, good. Mazel tov. Let's see. Oh, this is an interesting question. Hallmark cards. All right, so Hallmark cards introduced a line at 99 cents, about half the price of previously least expensive cards sold by Hallmark. So they're trying to appeal to a mass market that was price sensitive. What is the pricing strategy that's being used?
C.
Who could explain that? Why is that an example of penetration pricing? So they have some cards in their product assortment that they sell for $5, and there's some cards that they sell for $2, and they decided we're going to try and sell cards for 99 cents because they realize that some people are very price sensitive and that they don't want to spend $5 or even $2 for a card. They want to buy a card, a greeting card, for $1. And so their objective is to sell a lot of cards to this segment of the market. And the way that they decided to do that is to sell cards at a low price. So they introduced an economy line. So when we think about pricing, we think about very often economy, good, better, best. So the consumers, they could buy a variety of different cards from Hallmark at different prices. So introducing that card at 99 cents is an example of penetration pricing. So it's a new product that they introduced. They want to sell a lot of it, and so they're selling it at a low price. In some cases, manufacturers design products for different price points, and retailers apply, the best answer is A, approximately the same markup percentages to achieve the three or four different price points offered to consumers. So what would be an example of that? So for example, you might see products in the store that are $4.99, $9.99, $14.99, $19.99. We refer to those as magic price points. Those are magic price points in retail because at those price points, in given categories, there's a lot of volume that's done. And so the perception is that do people not realize that $19.99 is the same as $20?
JCPenney commercials and all like that with Ellen DeGeneres that make a point of that.
Yeah, so, but there's a perception, right? A lot of research has been done that that in certain categories that a significant amount of volume is done at those price points. And at Walmart, of course, it's a slight variation of that. So they have products that are like, instead of 1999, it's 1997 or 1897. So what this is saying is that the manufacturer and retailers are trying to work together. They understand that when a manufacturer brings a product to retailers, they have to understand that retailers are trying to hit these magic price points, and they need to be able to sell it to the retailers so that they could meet their margin requirements and be able to sell at those price points. Now, of course, you find yourself in a precarious situation when you've done that and you think you've done your homework, but you need to know your customer, because then Walmart says, well, that's great, but I'm not going to sell that at $19.97. I want to sell the product at $18.97. And so then what's going to happen is that if you want to sell to Walmart, then you're going to be less profitable. Unless,
but you just like guaranteed all your stuff is going to sell.
Not well. Sometimes, yeah. There's Walmart has made a lot of millionaires, and they've also made a lot of poor people. So be careful what you wish for. It could be certainly a great thing to be on the Walmart planogram in more than 2,500 of their stores. But keep in mind that very often, other retailers in the mass merchant channel and in other channels, they don't want to have what Walmart has, because Walmart is the low-cost producer of retailing. Their operating structure is such that they could sell products for less than other retailers and still be profitable, because they're selling general and administrative expenses. Their operating expenses are much less than other retailers. So retailers don't want to be in a situation where somebody comes into their store and they say, well, I saw the same thing at Walmart. So our responsibility is to differentiate the product for other channels, for other retailers. All right, the next question. The most commonly used pricing method for business products is cost plus pricing. So in fact, in order for partners to be successful, and I say partners, if you're selling to other businesses, then those are your partners, because their success and your success are tied together.
Like wholesalers.
Absolutely. So in business to business, it's very common. The costs, the customer realizes that the other party in the value chain adds value to the process, and the cost is not something that's secret. They know what their costs are, and they say, to your cost, we're going to add 15%. That's what the margin that we're going to allow you to perform the role that you perform in this process. And so it's important, because you might think, well, what about if you try and squeeze them and say, instead of 15%, we'll give them 5%. But then you're not a partner. They can't be successful. Successful companies understand this. Motorola, for example, other companies, they understand, yeah, what you're doing is an important part of the process, and so you need for your partners to be successful, because what if those partners go away, then that's a problem. So they need to be able to earn a living. Maybe there's other organizations that could provide the service for less. That's possible, but you have to keep in mind that it's got to be a win-win. You're not fooling anybody by thinking, ha-ha, we got him to sign for 5%. But they can't stay in business. Right? How are they gonna, how are they gonna cover their expenses? So we need to keep that in mind when we think about how we sell to other businesses. And that's talked about on page 350. All right, number 8. Product line pricing involves determining, 1, the lowest price product and price, and 2, the highest price product and price, and 3, the price differentials for all other products in the line. So that's another way of explaining what I share with you about the idea of good, better, best pricing. Isn't that what they're talking about here? The lowest price in the product line, the highest price in the pricing in the product line, right? So companies can have a good, better, best pricing strategy. Or sometimes we talk about economy, good, better, best, and premium, and then sometimes ultra premium. And basically what we're recognizing is that we sell products at different price points. And that's what this this question talks about, is product line pricing. That we can have products in the line that are going to be at different prices. They're not all going to be at the same price. Questions about that? The challenge for us, though, is to determine how reasonable it is, or how wide the gap could be in terms of price points. So, for example, Toyota, they sell cars, Echo, Corolla, Camry, Solara, Avalon. Those are all sub-brands, and so they sell them at $15,000 and $18,000 and $22,000 and $27,000 and $32,000. But that's different. That's okay. That's okay. But that's different from saying, well, we're going to sell cars at $30,000 and we're going to sell cars at $130,000. There's only so far that you could stretch your brand. All right, so let's see quickly before we go. So the next question says about different brands within a company's product line generally have different profit margins. For example, Nike variety tennis shoes. And so the best answer is C. Nike is using a product line pricing strategy. That's on page 356. And the next question is, when a seller represents a price as reduced, the item must have been offered in good faith at a higher price for a substantial previous period. The best answer there is B. A high price was set for the purpose of establishing a reference for a price reduction.
B was C.
C.
All right, have a good night.
Orange juice. Orange juice. Thank you.